The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben. This is Johnny. Johnny, how are you this week?
Yeah, doing not too bad. The weather's a bit nicer here, so I'm feeling pretty good. What about yourself, Ben?
I'm good as well. Thank you, Johnny. Yes, J1 resumed after the international break over the weekend with the one game on Friday night. And then the other nine taking place on Saturday. And it was a very good weekend for the home teams, Johnny.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of sunshine across the archipelago, and I think a lot of the teams enjoyed it. I know that the players like it, especially I know that like, the Brazilians are known for kind of getting into things when the weather warms up. And I think it definitely helped a few teams to get very, very nice results, including, of course, the defending champions who really, I think, came into their own after maybe a slightly up and down start to the season.
Indeed, indeed. So, yes, we will begin this week at the Nauru Stadium with the defending champions, Vissel Kobe, who are a big story this week after a big victory over Consadole Sapporo. 6-1 was the final score. But once again, we're going to have to talk about Sapporo, Johnny, for negative reasons as their horrendous start to the season continued. And, well, I mean, yeah, 6-1, the final score. But I think Sapporo got off fairly lightly.
Yeah, it was an absolute one-sided beatdown, wasn't it? I think, you know, Sapporo only had 5 shots in the whole game. I think one in the first half, which if anyone saw the zone highlights, I think on they would have seen it was like from miles out, Yuki Kobayashi firing well wide. And yeah, Idiguchi's own goal really was, I think that was the only way they were going to score. I mean, in fairness to Sapporo, I think the Neuvir Stadium has never been the happiest of hunting grounds. I think they even lost 4-0 in their golden year of 2018 when they were playing there. But, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, being honest with the listeners at home, of course, most podcasts, like when I don't write down exactly what I'm going to say, but I usually have kind of bullet points for each team or things I want to mention. But last week with Scott, we're a bit more off the cuff. And then, you know, after I was dwelling on it, was a bit too harsh in Sapporo. And then, you know, I think it wasn't harsh enough because, yeah, the defending here, I don't want to kick a team when they're down, but, you know, Ryu Takao came in. He was responsible for a couple of the goals. Just all over the place. I think for me the worst of them was the fourth goal. That they have a good chance just after half time themselves, and then Kobe go down the other end, and then Miyashiro is surrounded by I think 5 supporter defenders plus the goalkeeper, and he still turns around and sticks it in. 3 goals from set pieces in the second half. It just everything that possibly could have gone wrong for Sapporo did go wrong. Vissel, you know, if you're not on your game, you're not at the races, they're going to punish you. They get goals from all the big forwards, Osako, Muto, and then Miyashiro with a couple of goals. He was excellent again in that inside half position. You know, it's a stroll in the sun for Vissel Kobe, but, you know, Ben, where does Sapporo go from here?
Well, at this rate, Johnny, they're going straight down to J2. I mean, that's the easy answer at this stage of proceedings. But yeah, after a draw in match day one, it's 4 straight defeats, and well, I mean, yeah, they seem to be getting worse and worse. And after 2 weeks off to hopefully regroup, and as you say, it hasn't been a happy hunting ground for them, the Nauru. But yeah, you would have liked to see a little bit more backbone from the Sapporo team on their return to action, but instead they were behind inside 10 minutes, and it was basically game, set, and match inside the first 25 minutes after Taisei Miyashiro's first of the afternoon. And yeah, as you say, all of the big hitters for Kobe got on the score sheet. And as I said when I began the intro of this game, I think they did get off lightly because Osako opened the scoring. But yeah, he could have scored 3 or 4. Miyashiro and Muto got 2 each, but yeah, again, had other chances. And yeah, it was they were brutally exposed, I think, Sapporo. And yeah, Idiguchi's own goal, the only goal they scored on the afternoon, was a brilliant header from the edge of his own box. So yeah, it was just a horrendous display from Sapporo to continue their dreadful start to the season. We've already raised the possibility of Misha Petrovic's forced departure from the club. I mean, it would be you know, silly of us not to bring it up after the start to the season and the apparent lack of direction at the club. And yeah, certainly from the touchline to try and address things. So I mean, yeah, Johnny, we did have a message in from Kai who wants us to talk about Sapporo again, and he says he's been seeing a lot of blame on Petrovic, but he feels that the club is being too cheap and it hasn't replaced the talent that they lost in this off season. I can see that to some respect, Johnny, but I mean, I think with Petrovic, and we know how long he's been there and how important he's been to establishing them as a J1 club. But for me, it's the complete lack of flexibility and being able to adjust a game plan to cover for a lack of personnel maybe. And, you know, you might have some injured players out. You've got to change things and you've got to be a little bit more pragmatic. But that's just something that he doesn't seem to be able to do or to get across to his players.
Yeah, I think so. And it's quite interesting to see. Obviously, we've had no managerial changes yet in J1, but there's already been a firing in J2 with Tokushima's coach leaving. And what was interesting, the reason I mention that is that the kind of head of recruitment's also gone as well, which I think kind of if and when Petrovic does leave, if that's to happen, then you might see a kind of, he wouldn't be the only kind of head to roll. You might see people in the kind of personnel department go too. I mean, my kind of feeling is with head coaches, you know, we talked with Tom in pre-season about Petrovic's future. I think we talked with Alan Gibson. We talked with Scott McIntyre last week. I think kind of head coaches a bit like centre-backs. If you get mentioned too much in the pod, that's not really a good thing. You know, we haven't mentioned Kashima's like head coach this year since the kind of pre-season preview, which shows they are doing a lot better. And Sapporo, the fact that Petrovic's name comes up every week is really kind of showing where some of the issues lie. I think I would say a coach with less money in the bank at Sapporo would already be at least half a foot out the door. What I think is saving him is the kind of longevity, how long he's been there, how much credit he does have. And also the games are coming thick and fast. So we're talking on Monday, they've got a game against Nagoya on Wednesday, and then Saturday lunchtime they're playing Gamba. So I don't think there'll be any change this week. And you look at those two games and, you know, if they were to lose both of those, I don't think there would be a future for even someone with a history of Petrovic. The way J-League works, when you're kind of three games in a week, and, you know, Grampus have won the last two and Gamba are doing a bit better this season, but you could still kind of see one of those two home games, Sapporo getting something, whether that allows them to kind of bumble on. And I think behind the scenes that they must be having serious thoughts or have a sort of shortlist drawn up of potential successors, because as popular as Petrovic has been, and he's been around a long time, it's stopped working, hasn't it? Despite, you know, Scott made a kind of passionate plea last week about that some of the players are there to do better than what's been going on. I think it's just, you know, a bit maybe like Kanazawa last season in J2, that the one coach just stayed. You went to the well one time too often and is kind of paying for it. So yeah, I want to be. I like Misha Petrovic, and I know Sam always used to love him at the kind of early starts and over there in the UK. But yeah, I can only really see a messy ending here. Whether it's next week or whether it's a few weeks down the line, I kind of feel like the grains of sand, the grains of time are kind of running out for Misha Petrovic at Sapporo.
Absolutely. So just one more from Kai before we move on, Johnny. A number of questions, Kai, and we appreciate your message and getting in touch and getting involved with the podcast. I mean, yeah, Kai basically asked point blank, do you think they should fire him? And then also goes on to ask, how do you think they should line up with the players they have? So, I mean, he mentioned some of the players that have left and haven't necessarily been replaced. But with the horses he's got at his disposal at the moment, Johnny, do you think he's getting, well, he's not getting the best out of them. Do you think he's setting them up in the best way to try and address things at the moment? Or, yeah, if you were to offer him a grain of advice or, any kind of suggestions on how they could set up a bit better, what would your suggestion be?
With the really difficult thing is he's been there so long and he's always done the same thing. So, like, if you're trying to move it from like a 3-4-2-1 to like a a back four or like a 4-3-3 or something like that. With the players that they've all just gone through pre-season training, and a lot of them have been there for a while. You know, with Petrovic in charge, it is quite difficult. Like, almost like, you remember like Alex Ferguson used to kind of bring, I know this is not the best example for you, but he used to bring in someone like Walter Smith wasn't working for a bit of time, so Alex Ferguson brought him in as like a different voice and just someone else to do the training a bit differently. He almost needs, like, if he stays there, to bring in someone from outside to just give that, like, even if he's basically preaching a similar message to what Petrovic is saying, it's just been done in a slightly different way and a bit of a tweak, and it feels a little bit new because it's just got to that stage, you know, it's a bit tired and stale. And yeah, I think I said a few weeks ago, like, I think it was the Urawa game, it's like, it's kind of so obvious what Sapporo are going to do that even if they just changed it like a little bit, I think that might throw some opponents and sort of buy themselves some more time. And long term, you would probably, if you're going to change formation, you have to do that in a transfer window because they don't. I know Scott's kind of suggested some temporary kind of solutions at fullback or that, but realistically, they would then be a kind of square pegs and round holes scenario with kind of wingers playing at fullback or players, which is kind of what's happening now. The players are out of position. I think, you know, I don't want to call for him to be sacked, but it does seem like that's the kind of, that's the inevitable conclusion the way things are going now. I know Sapporo have, they've gone on these crazy winning runs and losing runs. So, I mean, who knows? They might go and beat Nagoya and Gamba 3-0 and then all's rosy in the garden again when we talk next week. But, yeah, I think you really need someone from the outside. I think Petrovic has maybe said all he can say. And I don't think he's been in the G League for years at Hiroshima, Urawa, now Sapporo. He's not going to change his spots. So, yeah, I'm sorry for the Sapporo fans. I can't be any more positive than that. But, yeah, just after seeing them get beat 6-1, and it felt like a 6-1. It wasn't like there were some lucky goals for VCL Kobe. The only lucky goal was the Sapporo one. Yeah, we should probably stop talking about Sapporo now because I think I'm just going to depress their fan base.
Yeah, I mean, it was one-sided to massively underestimate the performance from Kobe, which we don't want to do. But obviously, Sapporo and their start to the season has been a story we've been following since the beginning of the year. And hopefully for their supporters, this was the low point. And as Johnny says, they can start to lift their heads and get a result on Wednesday. Coincidentally, yes, as Johnny's mentioned, their visitors on Wednesday are another team that we've been concerned about in the early going, and that is Nagoya Grampus. They did get their first victory of the new season before the international break away at Kashiwa to ease some of the pressure on Kenta Hasegawa, and they went and made it to back-to-back victories at home against Yokohama F. Marinos on Saturday in one of the late afternoon games. But this was tinged with controversy, and Nagoya's equalizing goal with about 15 minutes to go came due to human error, according to F. Marinos' boss Harry Kuehl in his post-match comments on DAZN. It was controversial, and the F. Marinos bench and staff, they were absolutely fuming at what went on just before Tsukasa Morishima equalized for Grampus. But we'll go back to the first half, Johnny. I get the one of the major things to take from it is that Nagoya lost their center back Ha Chung Ray to a concussion 6 minutes before the break. He was replaced by Haruki Yoshida. More on Yoshida later, as he was the player who set up the equalizer. But it was an interesting first half, I think. Both teams taking time to fill each other out, but there were chances at either end. And Yokohama F. Marinos bringing in their is he third choice keeper, I guess, Johnny, these days, Fuma Shirasaka. We'd seen him come on for his J1 debut after William Pope had been sent off in the previous round. And he certainly had a baptism of fire here in his first start. He had to make a couple of saves in the first half to keep F. Marinos level.
Yeah, this was an interesting one because the back four in front of him wasn't exactly the most experienced. You had Renkato at right back, again, more on him later. And then you had Kamijima, and then Ken Matsubara was filling in at centre back. So with Shirasaka, you would think Grampus would have fancied having a bit of a go at this Mariners back line. And I think actually in the first half hour, Grampus shaded the chances. But like you mentioned, Ha-Chan Ray went off, and they also lost Yuya Yamagishi. He went off injured. So in the first 40 minutes, they lost two players. And it was a kind of stop-start game. That those players were down for a while going off injured. And then there's a couple of other stoppages. I think it was 7 minutes of additional time in the first half. And they really kind of lost their momentum a bit. And I think Kenta Hasegawa might have been listening in because he went to a back four for about 20 or 30 minutes in the first half just to kind of sort things out when they were making the changes. They were kind of 4-4-2. And they just sat in really deep with these two lines of four. And even the forwards were back and Mariners were kind of moving it side to side. And then the box was that congested that Mariners would play a kind of 1-2 down the flank and then just try and fizz something in, hoping for a deflection or a break, but it just didn't come. And then Grampus tried to break out, but they were so deep that it was like so far to get to the Mariners' goal. You felt like Mariners were really tightening the screw as it went to half time. But yeah, a bit tetchy, a bit of feeling each other out, but very, very intriguing first half.
Definitely. And then F. Marinos took the lead at 9 minutes after the break through an unlikely source in fullback Akatsuya Nagato. He was in the right place at the right time after F. Marinos had a number of chances either saved by Mitch Langerak or blocked by their defenders. I think once the ball was recycled in a second or maybe even a third time, Anderson Lopez and then Elber both had the shots blocked by Grampus defenders before the ball found its way out to Nagato on the left-hand side. He strode onto the ball and his shot took a slight deflection down before it went through Langerak's legs. So, a tricky one for the keeper to save, especially after the deflection. He was scrambling back across the face of goal and, obviously would like to have that one back, but I think the deflection made it, even more difficult for Langerak to save. But, at around about this time, Johnny, I was heading out on Saturday night and found my way into the Machida hub. And, I don't know whether I was a good luck charm at that point for Nagoya because, in the last 15 minutes, it all kicked off, but it all turned for the better for Grampus, beginning after a stoppage of play, I think around the 75th minute, wasn't it, when F. Marinos were going to make a single change, but then when Kota Watanabe went down lame, I think their best laid plans went up in smoke, and ultimately during this stoppage, Grampus brought a couple of players on, and F. Marinos ultimately weren't able to. And then seconds after the restart, as we said, it was 1-1 through Morishima.
Yeah, so I'll preface this with saying I'm not a referee. We don't have Alan Gibson on, but we had him on the last Marinos controversy with Uenaka coming on. But who would have thought it two controversies in two games over when players can or can't enter the field of play. So but before Harry Kuehl sends any angry emails to us, this is what I think happened in that Marinos, you can only stop play three times, I think, to make a sub. So Marinos were going to make their final stoppage of play to bring on Hatanaka back from injury for Renkato at right back. And then when they were about to make that sub, Kota Watanabe went down injured. And then they said, no, let's stop that. Because if they brought Hatanaka on, they then wouldn't be able to stop play again. So they'd have to play the rest of the game with 10 players. But they stopped the play, and then Grampus brought a couple of players on. But I believe you've got to do some paperwork with the fourth official, because he was over then doing some paperwork for the substitution. So I believe in the time he was doing that, then Grampus took a throw in and worked the ball back to Yoshida, who you mentioned, who then belts the ball over the top. And then Morishima, I didn't know, a volley lob was what I went for, but it doesn't really seem to kind of do justice to what it was that sort of went over Shirasaka into the goal. It's one of these things like with Uenaka in the game against Kyoto, if that hadn't led to like a dog so, we would never have mentioned it. And this, if Yoshida just lobbed it and had gone straight for a bye kick, it would never have been mentioned. But the fact it ends up in a goal, Harry Kuehl's booked, and there's F-bombs galore coming through the DAZN screens. Absolute chaos. I think I have to say I don't exactly know if that is correct. That's just my interpretation. I mean, Watanabe not being in the field didn't directly affect it because, you know, he's a midfielder, he's not very tall, and the ball was just hoofed out of defence straight over the midfield. What was interesting was that Kato was on his way off to be subbed by Hatanaka, and then he had to go back, and he is the player that Morishima runs away from. So whether Mariners have a bit of a claim there, but yeah, I hope I haven't put too many noses out of joint. That's just what I think happened. I understand Harry Kuehl's anger, but I'm not 100% sure if it's well directed.
Right, yeah, it's a tricky one. And as you say, yeah, if nothing came of the that particular passage of play, and yeah, the ball went out, and NF Mariners were able to bring their two subs on instead of the one that they originally intended, then yeah, as you say, it wouldn't have been worthy of a mention at all. But it just happened to be, yeah, that that 10 or 15 seconds where, as you say, Yoshida's long ball forward was, superbly cushioned, a cushioned volley. Yeah, that works for me, over Shirasaka, who, I guess, in great F. Marino's tradition of goalkeeping, had wandered off his line just beyond the penalty spot and, was unable to scramble back to pour away Morishima's shot, which seemed to travel in slow motion, but just inside the post and bounced over the line and into the net. And that was 1-1. So that was deflating for F. Marino's, that they still came again and they looked to get themselves a winner, but it was to come from one of their ex-players, Ryosuke Yamanaka, the man with a wand of a left foot. He came on for Takuya Uchida on the hour, and he won it in spectacular circumstances for Grampus in the 92nd minute with a free kick from inside the D, arrowed almost into the top corner, Johnny. It wasn't quite a postage stamp, was it? But a venomous strike from Yamanaka, and Shirasaka, well, it flashed past him before he could react, basically.
Yeah. I think the one thing I'd point out was that the foul, like the free kick, came from a very clumsy challenge with Kamijima going through the back of Masui. So it was a kind of tired foul. He looked like he was waiting for his full time shower, but you know, he gave away a foul. And yeah, you know, Mariners of all teams should know about the danger Yamanaka poses from set plays. I think he missed a game a couple of weeks ago, and then he's kind of been back on the bench the last couple of weeks. And he made a real difference when he came on. I know Uchida seems to be a favourite of Hasegawa's for some reason, but I don't know what he was doing at left wing back. But when Yamanaka came on, it just improved monumentally. I think, you know, his first touch was, I think you would have seen in the highlights, it was a kind of cross over a free kick that went across the face of Mariner's goal and was quite dangerous. And he was a constant outlet there, and absolutely, yeah, fantastic free kick here, a strike worthy of winning any game. I think Shirasaka gets a slight fingertip to it, but you know, it's just hit that hard and from that close, he's got no chance of stopping it. And you know, Yamanaka's a former Mariners player, but he's done the rounds of all the big teams, so I think he doesn't care anymore. He was behind the goal celebrating with the fans. A bit like we said the previous game, I think it's not the performance that really matters for Grampus. It's just getting the result, getting them out of that kind of bottom three, and that's them kind of bounce back with two wins, much more solid defensively. I really like the look of Mikuni, who I've been very critical of early on in the season. I think he looked quite good, both defending and on the ball here. And yeah, it wasn't pretty to watch, but yeah, for Grampus, all about the result. You know, Mariners have got a tough run now. They've got a Wednesday, Sunday, Wednesday. You've got Kawasaki, Vissel, Gamba. It's not going to get any easier for Harry Kuehl and his troops. So this will be a sore one to take. But you know, onwards and upwards for both sides.
Indeed, and yeah, they're level on the 6 points after this match day. Of course, F. Marinos with a game in hand. Johnny's mentioned there they'll be playing a Gamba the midweek after this to make up for the game that was postponed earlier on in the campaign. For for Grampus, a second straight win, and they travel up to Sapporo on Wednesday night, looking to make it three in a row, and yeah, to pile more agony on to Sapporo. All right then, so well, yeah, we haven't led off with the leaders, Johnny. Machida Zelvia carried on their winning ways on Saturday afternoon, so are we just that used to Machida winning already that we don't need to give them top billing anymore?
Look at their forthcoming fixtures, and I think they'll be first in a few weeks to come. But yeah, like we kind of mentioned in previous episodes, I mean, Manchester, they just keep winning, and they don't really do anything like spectacular, other than the fact they are top of the league, and they don't really do anything stupid either. So there's not an awful lot of controversy or things to comment on in Manchester's games. I mean, the things I found most interesting about this one was obviously man of the moment, Yu Hirakawa, got an assist hat trick hot on the heels of his goal for the Japan's Olympic team. And I only caught the highlights of this game, but it seemed like, especially in the second half, or basically in the whole game, any kind of chance or good piece of attacking play for Machida that wasn't like a throw-in or a corner came through Hirakawa. He was fantastic. And a couple of stats I dug up while I was looking away. I know it's only after round five, but maybe if we want to compare a bit more interest in Machida, compare them to Leicester City's title winning charge over in England a few years ago.
Oh,
Machida
wow.
have the second lowest pass completion numbers in J1 this season. Only Kyoto completing fewer passes, and they're also second lowest in possession after Fukuoka. So very, as Scott pointed out last week, a very different style to the way a lot of teams play in J1, and it's not to everyone's taste. But I think they're a fascinating case study. As I mentioned, the sort of upcoming games, got Hiroshima midweek. That's a mouth-watering tie, and putting Tosa to the sword is 3-1 is what you'd expect from a genuine title contender, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And some very interesting stats there, Johnny. I mentioned when we were talking about the Nagoya game that I headed out and was in the Machida hub on Saturday night. So after the Nagoya game finished, the manager of the hub whacked on the Machida game again. I presume they showed it live when it kicked off at 3 o'clock. So I was obviously chatting to friends, but trying to keep an eye on this game as it went along. I already knew the result and when the goals were scored, but it was really interesting to watch them and how hard they work. And it was, as you say, a hat trick of assists for Yu Hirakawa, the first for Kazuki Fujimoto in just the 5th minute. So Machida were well and truly on their way early doors. We talked about Morishima's cushioned volley. This was a lovely cushioned cross, I think, from Hirakawa across the box, and an excellent header from Fujimoto to give Zelvia the lead. But Tosu equalised in fine style through Marcelo Gyan about 10 minutes before the break. He was played through the centre by Taichi Kikuchi, and with the outside of his right boot, fashioned a lovely finish across Kosei Taniie and in off his far post. But then it was the Osei Hoon show early in the second half. O has done I think, a serviceable job so far, Johnny, of filling in for Mitchell Duke, who was again only fit for a very, very late cameo in this game. We know how important Duke was for the Machida team in their title-winning run in J2 last year. I think O's done a good job in general play so far, but in generally when it comes to getting on the end of things, it appears he hadn't been able to hit a barn door thus far. And indeed, he headed wastefully wide just before half time here. But with the score 1-1 in the 54th minute, Hirakawa set up 2 goals in 3 minutes for O. So I guess, for Go Kuroda, hopefully now he's seen O get off the mark, and he'll be away with a bit more confidence behind him, because, as I said, he had spurned a number of chances early on in the season. But hopefully this is him up and running.
Yeah, I think Osei Hoon's one of these players, I think, just been typecast because of his height or his big. Let's just have him, what Japanese call post play, like back to goal, holding the ball up and not really focusing on getting him goals. Because I remember, I think it was his first game for Shimizu when he came over from South Korea. It was against Gamba Osaka, and he absolutely battered, I don't know, with Miura and Shoji in defence for Gamba, but he looked an absolutely brilliant player, and he scored a goal, a really good header. And then Thiago Santana came back from injury, and he hardly played for about a year and a half. And now he's been given a new lease of life at Machida. He's not necessarily expected to score that many goals, but he's got two vital goals here. And yeah, I think that the service from Hirakawa, I mean, you'd argue, I think you or I might have been able to tap in that second one. Hirakawa's a kind of anticipation to intercept Kim Tae-hyun's pass and then moving in and putting it on a plate for Oh. But yeah, the second goal is really well taken. It's a good cross. And it looks a bit like Park is expecting the ball to go further into the middle because he kind of plants his feet and gets caught out a bit. But yeah, that was an absolute dagger to the hearts of Sagan Tosu to concede two goals like that in such quick succession, and it really was kind of game over after that. And you know, the penalty, Sagan Tosu conceding another penalty, and I mean, I would argue everyone knows I'm a big fan of Park Yo-gyu, although he didn't save this one. I think it was his aura, because he's known for saving penalties there.
Yeah,
he knew he had to aim right for the corner really hard, and that's why I put it wide.
Yeah, I was going to say he used the force. Yeah, I agree with you, Johnny. Yeah, Shota Fujio, who's had a terrific start to the season for Zelvia. Yes, even though Park guessed the wrong way, Fujio knew he had to put it in the absolute perfect spot in the bottom corner, and got his he got it all wrong, and fired the wrong side of the post late on. So it could have been 4-1, but the Zelvia faithful had to make do with a fourth straight victory, a 3-1 win over Sagan, and they maintain their 2-point lead at the top of the table, and the good times continue to roll for Machida Zelvia. It's a crunch game this early in the season, if they can be, when they host Hiroshima on Wednesday night. Should be a terrific game, that one. And I can confirm, Johnny, as I said, I was at the Hub, and this game kicked off at 3:00. There were still Zelvia fans staggering in to the Hub about 8:00, 8:30. So I don't know if they waited a long time for shuttle buses, or whether they'd been lubricating themselves elsewhere before making it into the Hub. But quite a boisterous occasion, and a number of Zelvia supporters out to celebrate their team's victory and their excellent start to the season. Now in second place in the table, we find Cerezo Osaka after their third straight victory. This was a 2-0 for them at home against Shonan Bellmare. Johnny, in one of the games that we picked out last week with Scott, that would be an interesting one, and two teams that have surprised us with their positive starts to the season. For Shonan, Song Bum-kyun made his long-awaited first start in goal, while for Cerezo, they were able to start four Brazilian forwards for the first time this season. Hopefully for Cerezo supporters is a taste of things to come. None of those got on the score sheet, Johnny, but it was Kakeru Funaki who headed in a corner from one of the Brazilians, Vitor Bueno, on the hour, who got to Cerezo on their way. And then Sota Kitano, who'd only been on the pitch for 3 minutes, netted the second with 8 minutes to go to wrap up a 2-0 victory for Cerezo.
Yeah, I watched this game on Sunday in full. Obviously, I knew the score. And after my perception of where these two teams would finish in the table, the game itself was actually far closer than, you know, 2-0 Cerezo sounds quite comfortable, but for a long time, especially leading up to that first goal, it was anything but. I think both sides would probably get into halftime a bit frustrated, as quite a lot of counter-attacking chances were butchered by a misplaced pass under not very much pressure. Or I think, you know, Shonan blocked a couple of Cerezo shots in the box when the players looked primed to score. I think was it Vitor Bueno and Capixaba got in each other's way at one point, or Kuno saw his shot blocked. And I think Lukian looked really good. He didn't get on the score sheet, but it was a constant thorn in the side of the Cerezo defence. And I think he had a shot blocked. I think it was Tanaka blocked his shot. And then Kim Jin-hyun had a really good tip over the bar just before half-time. So I think Shonan maybe... I think Cerezo were on the front foot for most of the first half, but Shonan were always a danger in the counter, and I think they probably edged it on chances. But they'll be so disappointed the way they conceded these two goals. They didn't really make... I mean, Cerezo are a good team, but they weren't really made to get into top gear. It's just it's a run in the mill. It was a decent corner from Vitor Bueno, but you know, Funaki just gets a jump on his defender, and it's there, 1-0. And then even after that, Shonan are still looking a bit dangerous. I think Abe had a shot just wide. And then, the second goal was just, you know, Cerezo have looked much better the way they've been playing this season, but this is pure Route 1. It's kicked out by Kim Jin-hyun, and I think that Kimminte and Leo Sierra got for the ball, and they can bump into each other and it hits Sierra's foot. And then, well, Keaton, first appearance of 2024, he's always looked very like exciting. He's not always been that composed, but this finish was, yeah, absolutely brilliant. Just off the bench, no sign of any coldness in those legs on. And then, you know, what a moment for him finishing in front of the Cerezo faithful. And I think this is the first kind of home game I've seen from Cerezo this season in full. And I think that they've changed maybe the pink in the kit a little bit, so it seems brighter. And, you know, that view, that kind of bit behind the goal that the Cerezo fans, is really, really eye-catching, because there's so many teams, you know, have got blues or reds or, you know, blacks in their colours. But Cerezo is very unique with that pink. So, you know, it must have been a great feeling for him. And yeah, after that, it went to 2-0. That really was game over. You could see Shonan heads dropped and Cerezo, you know, they knew the game was won. So, I mean, I guess they can say, you know, that they've won 2-0 in a game that they've had a pretty horrible record in recent years. They've seen off Shonan this time. And you know, all the Brazilians have started, like you said. It didn't quite click, but there's enough there. I was impressed, especially by Vitor Bueno. I think he looked really good. There's enough there. Justin Hubner's going to be in soon. Maicon was looking good down the flank. Keaton all got a good goal. So yes, it's all looking pretty sharp for the pink half of Osaka. And yeah, Shonan, they'll be disappointed with how they lost, but you know, they're competitive, and I don't think there's too much to be worried about just yet for Shonan.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you make about, yeah, the scoreline, yeah, obviously not telling the full story. And yeah, Lukian, oh gee, was he fired wide, and then yeah, as you say, Kim denied him on a couple of occasions in either half. And looked good, hasn't he, so far for Shonan. But yeah, he would have loved to have buried one of those chances to give them the lead. But as you say, yeah, Cerezo taking their opportunities when they came, even though they weren't at their best. So that's I guess in some respects a positive sign for Akiko Kogiku. And a third straight victory keeps them right up at the sharp end of the table. So for Shonan, they'll look to regroup on Wednesday night when they return to the Lemon Gas Stadium to face Tokyo Verde. Again, I think the next game we'll come on to, Johnny, is another example of the scoreline not really telling the full story. If you would just happen to glance at the scores and see Kashima 1, Iwata 0, you'd probably think, yeah, okay, a promoted side head up to the Kashima Soccer Stadium, maybe get a little bit of stage fright on such a big stage, and fluff their lines and return home with nothing. But this was far from that as well, was it, Johnny? Because Iwata had numerous chances. They outshot their hosts. They ultimately lost to a penalty that was, I think we both agree, was harshly awarded. And Iwata on another day could have scored three or four themselves, like they did obviously away to Kawasaki in the second game of the season. So while Shonan have regrets as they return from Cerezo Osaka, I think Iwata will do as well on their return from Ibaraki.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you compare those two teams, Shonan will maybe feel that they had the power to do something, or, you know, I guess, both sides missed chances, whereas there was no refereeing decisions really went against Shonan. It was more just them missing chances, whereas Jubilo, yeah, weren't clinical enough, but they were also kind of given a bit of a mountain to climb by. I mean, I think, was it the FC Tokyo VCL Kobe a few weeks ago we mentioned when Osaka missed that penalty? And like I said, imagine that game had been decided 1-0 with that penalty. Essentially, that this was like this game was decided by a penalty. I think Matsubara jumps, his hands in the air, but I think the referee thinks a hand that's way up in there, I think that he thinks the ball hits that hand, but it doesn't hit it, and it hits the other hand that's next to his side. And then they check it on VAR, and I assume that because it has kind of hit his arm, they can't say it's not a penalty. But yeah, this just didn't sit right with me, the fact that the game was decided by this penalty. And then even Yuma Suzuki just nails it up the middle and just misses Kawashima's foot. So he almost misses the penalty too, which I think might have been justice done. But, you know, Jubilo were well in this game. I think before the 1-0, I think Chavrich had a chance for Kashima, and then Germain had a really good header just wide. And you know, Hayakawa and the Kashima goal was definitely the busier of the two goalkeepers. I think, again, a rare chance to mention one of the less mentioned ones of my Johnny's one to watch this season, young Furukawa. He had a lovely run near the end of the near the end of the game, it kind of cut inside and it shot just agonisingly wide. And then it seemed after that, that kind of inspired Jubilo. They really threw the kitchen sink at Kashima, but they didn't budge. I think Sekigawa with a good block, and then Hayakawa really earned his corn. So yeah, I think Jubilo on that long bus journey back to Shizuoka, I think they'd be but very frustrated with the referee, and also, like it's been kind of mentioned before, the lack of clinicalness in front of goal, because this is the third time in five games they've lost by just one goal. And I think the other two times against Kashiwa and Gamba, they've had their chances, they just haven't really taken them. So they went with a kind of more 4-4-2 in this game with Jermaine and Peixoto up front, and hopefully they can get something more out of that partnership, because they're really going to need to, you know, score goals consistently. It's no use scoring five in one game away from home, and then you can hardly kind of hit a barn door in any of the other games. So yeah, I think they've shown themselves to be competitive. They need to take that and then kind of kick on to the next stage and get some results. I think Antlers can be satisfied with the result, but little else really. They were outplayed. I know they've had some kind of injury problems with Kaishu Sano. He pulled out of the national team squad. So, you know, your favourite Shoma Doi, he was in as a holding midfielder alongside Kei Chinen, which I think it rather worked like you might expect two attacking players like that playing in central midfield. So yeah, I think they've signed a new player. I have to apologise, I forgot to write his name down, and I'm not going to try and... It's a very, very long Serbian name that I'm going to butcher, so I'll mention him next week. But I think he might be good to go maybe from next week, and then they can get some options back, because there was no Sano and there was no Higuchi, and he likes Nago as a number 10, so he went for Doi and Chinen. So yeah, Popovic doesn't have too many players to work with, but yeah. Three points, and then hopefully for them a better performance in their next game.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess there's similarities from the two victors. Yeah, as we mentioned, is that as they weren't at their best, but they were able to beat Shonan. And again, yeah, somewhat fortunately here, thanks to the penalty decision, Antlers have squeaked past plucky visitors Iwata. And yes, fourth in the table with 10 points from their four games. Next, we'll move on to the Saitama Stadium, where Urawa hosted Fukuoka. Fukuoka took the lead just before the half hour when Iranian striker Shahab Zahidi pounced on a miscontrolled ball by Ryoma Watanabe, who's been filling in at left back for Reds in the last few games. Zahidi bore down on goal and from well beyond 25 yards fired in at Shusaku Nishikawa's near post, one from distance that, I think Nishikawa would have expected to save. But, Zahidi's shot found its way into the net, and, he could celebrate and, making history as the first Iranian to score in J1. So congratulations to him. But Watanabe made up for miscontrol just past the hour when he equalised for Reds with his first goal for the club. He'd just shifted from left back up to left midfield, with Ayumu Ohata being introduced at left back, and a lovely cushioned volley at the back post from Watanabe got Reds back on level terms. And then 8 minutes after that, Thiago Santana fired home a penalty to make it 2-1 to Reds. And a positive win for them. Johnny, coming from behind after Zahidi's goal.
Yeah, I think it's another kind of slow step. You can see the Reds are kind of starting to build up a bit of a head of steam. I mean, you could say, you know, the two goals have come from a goalkeeping error and a penalty. But I think, you know, this is the kind of game that Reds would have probably lost last season against, you know, a team like Fukuoka are very strong defensively. They've taken a surprise lead. They're just going to sit back. Reds struggled to break down those kind of teams, but against Fukuoka this year, they created loads of chances. And I think it's a really positive thing that Santana's got off the mark, even if it was a penalty, because he's been a kind of chief culprit of missing chances. He missed a few in this game. And you know, Nagaishi, although he is culpable, I think, for that first goal, I think he makes about five or six saves in this game. And you know, he really prevents it from being a rout. I think it could have been 4 or 5-1 if he hadn't been on his game. And you know, Nishikawa, you mentioned he was culpable for that first goal. But despite all of Red's pressure and all their chances, it's actually him. He has to produce a really good save near the end of the game to preserve Red's 2-1 victory. So, yeah, I think a good 3 points for them. It was quite interesting after the 4-4 with Shonan. They brought in Kenny Wao in for Koizumi in central midfield. I think that makes sense to have essentially three conventional central midfielders there to protect the back four. I would like to see going forward when they get a bit more confidence and maybe when Schultz comes back, if again they revert to maybe a more of a number 10, like a Nakajima or even that Okubo was in at left wing for this game, or Matsuo or someone in that more central area. But yeah, for Reds, it's a good, important win against a tough opponent. And yeah, for Fukuoka, after a kind of brightish start to the season, they're really stuttering a bit. You know, as you know, the FC Tokyo took them to the cleaners a bit in the game before the international break, and they made 5 changes for this game. You know, the predicted ones we thought, like Zahedi and Matsuoka coming in, it didn't really seem to work. So yeah, plenty of work for Fukuoka going forward. But yeah, Reds, I think, yeah, keep your eye on them. That things are slowly starting to move in the right direction at the Saitama Stadium.
Indeed. So yeah, Reds get revenge for their defeat in the Levain Cup final towards the end of last season. And yeah, things beginning to turn for Reds, Johnny. Hopefully, not too quickly, because they travel to the capital to face FC Tokyo on Wednesday night, a game that I'll be getting along to. And Tokyo come into that game with their tails very much between their legs. You've just mentioned their performance before the international break when they won away at Fukuoka. And hoping that they would turn on a performance away at Kawasaki in the Tamagawa Classico on Saturday afternoon. But instead, Tokyo laid a massive egg and lost 3-0. I mean, Kawasaki were far from their fluent best, but they didn't have to be. And this was a dreadful performance from Tokyo. I know they had some players away on international duty, but this is just not good enough, especially on the back of what was such a good performance away at Fukuoka. Really disappointing display. I mean, they did go behind in somewhat unfortunate circumstances about 10 minutes before half time, when Yasuki Kimoto slid in to try and cut out a cross from Sota Miura. He either got a shout from Hatano, his keeper, and didn't have time to react, or there was no shout of keeper from Hatano. Basically Kimoto slid in, deflected the ball against the post, and Frontale captain Yasuto Wakizaka pounced to fire in from a tight angle. But then Hatano was shown a straight red card with 18 minutes to go after he raced out of his box and upended Edison after a ball was played over the top by Daya Tornal. Absolute cast iron straight red card for the Tokyo keeper. That meant that Taishi Brandon Nozawa had to come on for the last 20 minutes or so. And inside the last 10 minutes, he was beaten twice. First by Shin Yamada in the 83rd minute, and then Kento Tachibanada in the second minute of stoppage time drove home from the edge of the area. So, I mean, this is on the positive side for Frontale, Johnny, it's a victory for them, and quells some of the concerns about Toru Oniki's future. Again, they weren't at their best, but for Tokyo, this was just a really disappointing display, and it doesn't bode well for me on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I'll focus on Frontale, because we mentioned before that Oniki would have to go back to the drawing board or the magnet board, and he did to an extent. He went back to a system he used several years ago. I think the 4-2-3-1 with I think Seko and Tachibanada sitting in front of the back four and Wakizaka in the kind of number 10 role. And obviously Marcinho was suspended for this game, but they did have Erison back. And I think he seemed to give the FC Tokyo defence a really hard time with his pace and power and directness. So I think that was a real kind of fill-up for them anyway, to have him back so soon after being out injured. And yeah, you're right. The first Frontale goal definitely had a strong element of luck. I mean, I guess to kind of counteract that, I think Frontale definitely had the better chances in that half. I mean, it would have been interesting if FC Tokyo could have got into half time and then kind of come out, regroup in the second half, maybe have a better go of it. But yeah, that was a bit of a kind of a damaging blow not long before half time. And then yeah, when it was 11 versus 10, yeah, they really just kind of turned the screw with the Toei and Yokohama boys doing the damage, with Yamauchi kind of just kicking the ball off Yamada, and it seemed to somehow go in. And then yeah, Tachibana there with the finish in injury time, just to kind of add salt to the wound. So I'm sure Frontale would have been, yeah, their fans would have enjoyed their Saturday night after this game. But yeah, they've got tough challenges away, including Yokohama F. Marinos on Wednesday. So I don't know how long that mood will stay as positive as it is. And you mentioned, yeah, you've got Urawa in the next game. And yeah, I think the next couple of games, I think when we come on to talk about the next fixtures, I think I've actually highlighted it's Urawa and then Kashima at home, isn't it? So two very tough original 10 opponents for FC Tokyo. But they are both home games. So, I mean, yeah, you'd have to be confident getting a result in one of those games. I'm not sure which of the two. But, I mean, yeah, Peter Klimovsky, any murmurings of kind of discontent, or that the fans still quite firmly behind them despite kind of results like this?
Oh yeah, no, I think it's a little bit early doors to be pushing any panic buttons, but yeah, it was just a really disappointing display. But they've been a bit Jekyll and Hyde, I think, thus far, haven't they, Tokyo? A couple of the early performances were decent, and obviously very good against Fukuoka, but this was not good enough, and they'll hope to turn it on in their two home games in the next few days, as you mentioned, Johnny, both at the National Stadium, playing two games there in the space of 5 days, as you say, against Reds and Kashima. So, we'll see which version of Tokyo fronts up on Wednesday night. The other half of Tokyo Verdy were again celebrating late drama on Friday night, Johnny. As we've said just before the international break, they finally were on the end of something positive late on before the break against Niigata, and then I guess they carried on in a similar vein against Kyoto at Ajinomoto Stadium on Friday night. They were poor, and I think deservedly 2-0 down inside the first half hour. Yuta Toyokawa scored an absolute screamer in the 22nd minute, and then it was great to see Taichi Hara get off the mark this year at 4 minutes after that. But Kyoto were not quite able to kill them off, and Verdy kept on coming. They simply had to be better in the second half, and they were. And a late brace from Itsuki Somino, the first from the penalty spot with the 10 minutes to go, after Hiroto Yamami had been upended by Shinotsuke Fukuda, made it to 2-1. And then in dramatic scenes in the third minute of stoppage time, Johnny, Somino slid in to convert a cross. And the Tokyo Greens could go home happy.
Yeah, Verdy are getting the hang of this J1 thing now. They're getting penalties in their favour, and they're turning it around in injury time. So that's them out of the nascent league table bottom three. So yeah, onwards and upwards for them. I think, yeah, as you mentioned, it was a bit of a struggle early on, because, you know, I'm not quite sure why Kyoto have loaned players to Verdy, but, you know, Fuki Yamada and Yudai Kimura, they're both on loan, so they didn't play in this game, so it meant a bit of a reshuffle that didn't really kind of help Verdy. And Sanga, for their part, they seem to have completely run out of centre backs, because after, you know, Apia Tawia, he was red carded in the last game, and then Daiki Kaneko went in there, but he seems to have been injured. And then the second half last week, and in this game, they had Yuta Miyamoto, a 171 centimetre, I thought, you know, fullback and central midfielder, but he was in at centre back, and he did all right until maybe the kind of bitter end of the game. But yeah, what an absolute worldie from Toyokawa. Absolutely phenomenal strike, and he really seems to have picked up where he left off last season, which is great for Kyoto, as is Taichi Hara getting his first goal. He's obviously no stranger to the Ajinomoto Stadium turf, and you know, it was like the Red Sea parting in front of him as he just charged through and put it in the back of the net. So I think Joe Fukov had some stern words about defending of that goal. And then you know, Itsuki Somino, who was someone who we discussed last week with Scott, especially related to the Olympics. I mean, honestly, I think Scott might have watched him more in Japan age level of football than me, because I'd never been particularly impressed with him. And he only won J1 goal in 42 appearances before this game, and he's trebled that in one 20-minute spell. It looks quite a tired foul by Fukuda, very clumsy on Yamami. Yamami gets goal side of him, and he's never going to win the ball. It's just a stonewall penalty. And yeah, Gu, very, 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 very big man. I've seen him in the flesh, and Gu Sung-yoon is an absolute massive man. And he almost gets to the penalty, and then it just creeps home. So that gives Verdi hope. And then another very big man, Tsunashima, was on, and they kind of threw him up front, and he does very well, drags in the left back and the centre back, flicks the ball outside to Saito, who centres for Somino. And yeah, it must have been a great scenes and for the Verdi faithful, and they enjoyed their Friday night. So yeah, good point for them, given where they were. Although I think maybe pre kickoff they might have targeted this for a win. Kyoto, on the other hand, yeah, they'll be happy Hara got on the score sheet. But they'll be absolutely furious to throw away 2 points. I mean, Api Atawia will be back for the next game. I'm not sure the other defenders like Suzuki or Matsuda, if they'll be able to get any of them back. They really need some help. They've got a Kansai derby with Gamba on Wednesday. And then, again, I'm sure they'll be targeting for a win, but it's very losable as well against Jubilo next weekend. So, yeah, but positives up until maybe the kind of last 20 or 30 minutes. But, yeah, it's spoils shared. I guess, yeah, but Verdi will be the happier of the two, given the way the game panned out.
Yeah, indeed. So, late drama again. And as we said, Verdi on the right side of it again. And, yes, they travel to the Lemon Gas Stadium, as I think I mentioned earlier, to face Shonan on a Wednesday night. All right. Well, apologies, Johnny, but we're leaving Gunma Osaka until the second last game. But it was one of the three draws in a match day when Gunma returned to the Edeon Peace Wing Hiroshima to face Sanfrecce. Of course, as we mentioned last week, and as we spoke about previously, Gunma helped to christen Hiroshima's new stadium in a preseason match. Gunma spoiled the party on that occasion, and they threatened to again after Velton got his first goal for the club in the 76th minute. So at that point, your bubble was burst very, very soon after that. But you must have held out huge hopes that at that point, Gunma, after going ahead, would be able to hang on and indeed spoil the party again.
Yeah, I think it was the right time to score, because in the first half, I guess anyone who saw the highlights would have seen the ridiculous Mutsuki Kato miss where, 2 yards out falling over and then the ball hits both posts. A massive, massive let off for Gunma. But I'm trying to be as neutral as possible here. I think Gunma shaded big chances in the first half, maybe 2-1. And on both occasions, Alano and Yamada, they should have shot earlier. If they had, they might well have scored a goal. But in hindsight, if they had scored too early, then you just face an onslaught, like 45 minutes of Hiroshima pressure, they'd probably lose 2-1. But yeah, Welton got the goal. And yeah, the first half especially, he was really impressive. He kept the Hiroshima defence honest. And Gamba were, both those Yamada and Alano chances came from counter-attacks, and a lot of their attacking threat did come down the left side through Welton. I think Juan Alano was back from injury, but he wasn't fully fit. And the pace and power of Welton, they didn't really know what to expect. And he gave, I think, Shiotani and Nakano down that flank all sorts of trouble. And then into the second half, Hiroshima had really kind of put their foot down in the accelerator. I think they'd hit the post twice. I mean, one of them was a kind of mishit cross, and then I think one of them is an Ohashi header off the outside of the post, and then there's a mishit corner that hit Neta Lavi and almost squirmed in, and that was all in a kind of 10-15-minute spell. So, yeah, I fully understand what Hiroshima fans were going through. Everyone's seen that type of game when your team's just on top and the goal won't come. And then you think, bang, what's going to happen? We're going to go down and we're going to concede a goal down the other end. And yeah, Gunma caught them, I think, their first kind of counter-attack of the second half. Lavi does really well and then fed Sakamoto. And on first viewing, I thought it was maybe a mistake from Osako. I don't think it is, though. I think it's a 3-on-2 counter-attack. And it's a pretty decent ball from Sakamoto right between the defender and goalie. So Osaka palms it out, but they're outnumbered, so it goes straight to Welton. And yeah, you think, bang, here we go. We could actually get 3 points here. But yeah, unfortunately, like the Jubilo game in the previous game, we conceded right after scoring. And yeah, it wasn't to be.
It wasn't. Yeah. Speaking about Osaka, I wondered whether he could have gone with a punch and tried to get it further away from goal. But yeah, I mean, it was traveling, obviously. And yeah, he might have thought that he'd done enough with his parry. But yes, as we say, Welton was at right place at the right time to become the first player ever to wear number 97 and to score a goal in J1. I haven't fact checked that, Johnny, but it simply has to be correct. So I'm going to run with it. But yeah, as we've said, the goal Gumbly did not last for long. Indeed, it only lasted for 2 minutes when Naoto Arai, who you might be familiar, listeners, as a former player, well, now former player of Albirex Niigata, he joined Hiroshima during the international break. And in his first appearance for the club, having only come on 3 minutes earlier, well, he basically came on a minute before Welton scored and 2 minutes after that, with not sure whether it was actually his first touch or not, but he scored an absolute screamer along the floor past Jun Ichimori from about 25 yards. A tremendous goal and echoes of Emil Salomonsson. Johnny, what could he possibly do for an encore after a goal like that in his first ever Hiroshima appearance?
Well, I don't know if he'd be too popular with his teammates, because he showed up his forwards for their poor finishing or kind of lack of penetration. He showed them how to do it. Yeah, I think he's probably a bit like Hiroto Yamami with his goal for Gamba against Shimizu when he was still a university player. He may have set himself up to a level he's never capable of achieving. So, yeah, absolutely phenomenal finish. Because you kind of think sometimes, you look like, what could we have done better? But, you know, most likely you think that the right wing backs can have a shot from there. It'll probably go over the bar or go wide or go straight at the goalie. But, you know, fair play to Arai. He's caught it and he's fired it in. And yeah, I'm sure he enjoyed that, because he's, funnily enough, Gamba have played 4 games this season and Arai has played against him twice. And the last time, you might remember, he gave away a penalty, the decisive penalty for Niigata to allow Takashi Usami to win the game at Panasonic Stadium. So certainly a better afternoon for him against Gamba on Saturday. But, you know, I mean, when that goal went in right after Gamba scored, I thought, oh, we're going to lose this 2-1. And, yeah, Hiroshima, they didn't really kick on like you would think. And it was actually, you know, Gamba had the best chance to win it with, I think, Sakamoto teed up Meshino. He was back from injury, but he got the sand wedge out when he should have used the driver, I think, and put it way over the bar. I think, yes, it just kind of petered out into a 1-1 draw, which I think definitely... But for Gamba, it's a more positive result. It's throwing out more stats. I'm sure that this is the first time Sanfrecce have dropped points at home in the new stadium. I didn't have to look that one up, but I can remember all the results offhand, because there's only been 3. right. So I think, because we have we get three games this week, I don't think this is really the kind of game either side would have chosen to be the first one, because it was tough. Like especially the first 40 minutes, I think both teams gave as good as they got. And it was a good advert for J1. It was quite an even game, quite end-to-end. But I think this would have taken quite a lot out of both sides. And you know, Sanfrecce don't have that deep a squad. They've got very good players in the 11. So, yeah, match it away in midweek. It'd be very interesting to see what kind of condition they're in for that one. Gamba do have a bigger squad, but, you know, whether they can actually find the balance or get the right 11 out remains to be seen. But, yeah, it kind of follows in the Gamba trend of picking up points in games we wouldn't have picked up points in last season. I think Nakatani's definitely helped at the back, because Gamba really restricted Hiroshima from good quality chances. I mean, this is a game we've lost 3-0 and 5-2 in the last kind of 2 seasons. So a 1-1 is an absolutely fantastic result for Gamba. Welton looks really good. For Hiroshima, I mean, I think they need to get someone other than Mitsuda to hit some of the corners, because this is the second time this season I've just seen him waste corner after corner. But yeah, I remember, I think it was Yo Nakaragawa did a really good analysis on Hiroshima, because they always have so many shots, but they don't necessarily have clear-cut chances. And it is a tactic, But I think that the stats I saw, they had 12 more shots than Gamba on Saturday, but only 0.2 higher expected goals. So it's not like there were particularly clear-cut chances. So and Pierros didn't play in this game, and you know, Douglas Vieira has been a good sub for them in recent years. He's injured now. So I guess if Pierros comes back and they can go back to that front three, Marcos Junior is another player they've got to come back in. So there's definitely more options, and a frustrating afternoon for Hiroshima. It just isn't an aside, because they have played Gamba twice. I would love, you know, I'd love to know Michael Skibber's true thoughts on what Gamba's real level is, because I think he's got a really good insight into the level of this year's Gamba. Because I actually, but before I came on, I had some okonomiyaki with Victor Arroyo, J1 Analytics on Twitter, and he was asking me, should you get Gamba going for the title, top four? It's like, no, none of that, Victor. But I'd be very interested to know what someone like Skibber genuinely thought about Gamba's level, because I'm still erring on the side of caution. There's a couple of winnable but also very losable games coming up, so we'll see after that.
All right then. So yeah, a really interesting game at the Edion Peace Wing, Hiroshima, and yes, the shares were spoiled with the game finishing 1-1. And Naoto Arai, we've mentioned the scoring the equaliser for Hiroshima, a former Niigata player, and we've tried to segue our way through this episode, Johnny, and we've arrived at the natural conclusion with Arai's former club, Niigata, who played out the final game that we'll review from the match day. It was another 1-1 draw between Albirex and Kashiwa, and again, the same as the other two draws at Ajinomoto and at Edion Peace Wing. The visitors took the lead in this one. For Reisola, Korsuke Kinoshita netted in the 15th minute. And, well, I think, Johnny, I'll get your thoughts in a second, but I think Reisola should have been over the hill and far away by halftime. And, definitely by just before the hour, when the veteran Niigata defender Kazuhiko Chiba fired in a lovely leaping cushioned volley to equalize. But I think Niigata had a pretty rough day of it. And for them, I think they were fairly fortunate to take a point at home. Reisol showed that their promising start to the season, I think, is no mirage. And if it wasn't for some wasteful finishing from themselves and some excellent goalkeeping from Ryosuke Kojima, Reisol would have definitely left with all 3 points.
Yeah, I think Kojima is the MVP of this game. He had his Park Il-gyu Superman shirt on. I think, according to the stats, he had 10 saves, including like nine from efforts inside the box. So he definitely earned his wages in this game. And Kashiwa, they were so dominant in that first half to kind of only go in 1-0 up. You're always kind of worried, especially away from home, a tough place to go to like Niigata. Is that going to be enough? So it proved. I think the 38-year-old Kazuhiko Chiba with a volleyed finish that any forward in the division would be proud of in his first appearance of 2024. And Kashiwa were almost made to pay right at the end, weren't they? When I think the Nagakura teed up Matsuda to shoot over, but ultimately 1-1. I think Niigata would probably be the happier of the two. They've only lost once this season. They've been outplayed a bit, but they've managed to scrape a point. But I think these two teams in the very early league table are 7th and 9th. And I don't know if you'd agree, it had the feel of a kind of mid-table battle. I don't think we'll really be talking about either of these two teams at either end of the table this season. Would you maybe go along with that?
I would, and I think that's music to the ears of supporters of both clubs, especially Reisol, of course, after their absolutely horrendous season last year. But they do appear to be much better in the early going. Again, obviously there's plenty of time for things to turn sour, but I agree. I don't think that's likely to happen. And their positive start to the season looks like it might be for real. But a disappointing display for Niigata, even though, as Johnny says, they could have nicked it at the end there through Eitaro Matsuda. But he fired over. All right then, so that's all 10 games from J1 Match Day 5 rounded up, and we'll look ahead as there are two rounds of matches to be played before we do our next episode of the podcast, Johnny. So on Wednesday, Match Day 6, will be played, a full round of games, and there are some derbies on the slate, and obviously a fascinating encounter on the docket at the Machida's Gion Stadium. So if you would to direct the listeners in the direction of one or two games on Wednesday night, obviously keeping in mind it'll be difficult to watch more than one at once unless you've got numerous devices on the go. What would be your pick of the match day?
Johnny's pick of the match day.
Thank you.
Well, there's two really obvious ones, so I'm gonna have to say, it's difficult to separate them. Let's just go for the top of the table, Machida against Sanfrecce Hiroshima, because I believe that's a fixture that probably hasn't ever taken place before in a league game without looking that up.
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, this will be a kind of real test of both sides' mettle. We mentioned before Machida have this massive squad, but they've not really had to delve too deep into it so far. But now with the game starting to come thick and fast, they might have to do a bit of rotation. And it's interesting to see how they can compete, kind of playing every 3 or 4 days. And, you know, Hiroshima's style is very intense, very in your face. I am really interested to see how these two styles mesh. I guess Hiroshima will probably play a very, very similar team to the one that faced Gamba. And then, Machida, I guess, too, will probably, start at least with very similar members. So, how Hidakawa goes down that flank against the vaunted Hiroshima defence. And, if Hiroshima are able to bring Pierros back in, what kind of effect that will have? Yeah, I think that's the one if I had to pick one. But, definitely, I'm sure, Marinos fans and Frontale fans, there's only one game they're going to be watching, and that's the Kanagawa Derby. Marinos coming off that kind of stinging loss to Grampus right at the end last weekend. They'll be desperate to make amends for that in front of their fans. It was interesting to see, when the players did their bow in front of the fans after the Grampus game. The fans are still very much on side. They gave them a clap and supported their efforts. For Frontale, they bounced back with aplomb against FC Tokyo, but you're only as good as your last result. So, I mean, can they keep it going in this big game? Fascinated to see. It's almost, I know it's still school holidays, but it's not my holiday, so maybe I'm complaining, but it almost feels like these two games are kind of wasted in a Wednesday night. I don't know if that's just me being selfish, but those two are definitely two to look forward to. And of course, Ben, you said you're going to the, I'm very, very jealous, you're going to the National Stadium to see FC Tokyo Urawa. How do you see that one shaping up?
Well, my expectations aren't all that high for Tokyo, Johnny, after Saturday's result. But as we've said, they've been a Jekyll and Hyde to this point, Tokyo. So, hopefully they will turn up and put on a decent display. Just looking forward to my first trip to the new National Stadium. Obviously went to the old one numerous times, but to get a first look in person at the new stadium is something I'm very much looking forward to. And as I say, hopefully my side can do the business. We've mentioned it's a midweek for derbies, and I take your point, Johnny, that on a Wednesday night in April maybe isn't the the J League isn't maximizing the potential crowds for some of these games. We've already talked about there's a Kansai derby at the Suita Stadium with Gamba hosting Kyoto, and one for the environmentalists is the green derby at the Lemon Gas Stadium when the Shonan host Tokyo Verde. Could that be the long-awaited first victory back in J1 for the Tokyo Greens? We shall see. The Kanagawa Greens are definitely hoping that will not be the case. So, a really interesting slate on Wednesday night. And then we back up again on the weekend, Johnny, for match day 7. And, goodness knows what will happen up at the Sapporo Dome on Wednesday night when Sapporo host and Nagoya, because they're on again on Saturday lunchtime, Johnny, when they host your Gamba Osaka side. Then we have the other 9 games for the round taking place on Sunday, and again there are some belters on the slate, no question.
Yes, what's interesting is I think some teams have significantly harder kind of like two games in a row than other teams, because I think I highlighted like 3 games in each round, and I think four of the teams in the games are the same. So, you know, after Mariners play Kawasaki on Wednesday, they then travel to play Vissel Kobe on the Sunday. And you might remember that last year, this was an absolute classic, Vissel racing into a two-goal lead, and then Mariners coming back to win 3-2. So more of the same, please. Another five-goal thriller suits me. And it's the first versus second from last season battling it out. So, yeah, that's definitely one that you want to tune into. And then also, Machida, hot in the heels of hosting Hiroshima. And prior to hosting Vissel Kobe the following week, they then travel to Kawasaki. So, I mean, again, we don't know, speaking of Monday night, we don't know what Machida's result is going to be against Hiroshima, and we don't know what Frontale's result against Marinos is going to be. But, I mean, even if both sides lose, that still sets it up as a kind of fascinating one. Then, well, if another side was to lose again, that they both have the bit between their teeth. But, yeah, I think, again, has Oniki's style really changed that much, or do we have a complete contrast in very direct versus very kind of slow and patient and build it up from the back? Another kind of fascinating kind of contrast in styles. So I think that's one you want to keep your eyes on. I feel a bit more confident in this round of really recommending Vissel against Marinos is the one you really want to tune into. But I mean, again, your boys FC Tokyo, like we kind of alluded to earlier, they've got a pretty tough, pretty interesting game against Kashima Antlers. You can't get time off to go and see that one, can you?
No, unfortunately not. Yes, our reunion with Ranko Popovic, that'll be a very interesting one, no question. But Tokyo, as we said, playing at the National Stadium twice in the space of 5 days. So, yes, they'll either be cock-a-hoop for that one if they can get a result against Reds, or they'll be really down in the dumps after the Classico defeat. And then, if they don't get a result against Reds, then, the pressure will be right. Rising on Tokyo with the Kashima game on the Sunday evening. All right then. So yeah, plenty of interesting games up and down the slate on both Wednesday and this weekend to come. All right then, Johnny. Well, we'll leave it there. And it's going to be a feast of football over the next week. And I look forward to rounding it up with you on next week's episode.
Yeah, we tried to power through this week, but I don't know if we weren't able to keep it below an hour, so we kind of failed in that account. And yeah, next week we'll definitely not be able to keep it below an hour, because there'll be a ton of football to talk about, and I can't wait to talk about it next week.
All right then, so we'll leave it there. That's it for this episode of the J-Talk podcast. Johnny and I would like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review the two rounds of J1 action. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.